The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, August 25th, the Propped Up by Pillows edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah. Welcome back.
Thank you. And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, guys. I'm really happy to be back. I was in Ireland where I discovered that we have fans, serious fans.
That's so awesome. Cool.
Literally, someone, like the first day I got there, I was in a relatively small suburb of Dublin, and someone walked up to me and recognized my voice, who had been listening to XX Gabfest for a long time. Then we tweeted for a while. And then Brian, I'm giving a shout out to Brian, who's like a big XX Gabfest fan and who invited us to his house. And like, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. It was amazing.
The Irish are friendly people, which I'm saying looking
exactly.
At June, that Brit. Sorry.
Yeah, we'll take the Irish over the Brits.
Oh, wait, no.
Well, Noreen's Irish, right? So I have one take on
I was
there.
Starting something. Sorry.
I'm being restrained. That's what you do.
All right, back to America. Back to America. Back to America. Let's reel us back to America. Our three topics today, which are about America.
We're
the
laughing
first
like,
one.
Like Tulsa. Woohoo, right, woo!
That's true. Not necessarily things America can be proud of, but they are things that are happening in America. First, we're going to talk about Nate Parker, a filmmaker, actor, about to come out with an ambitious new film called Birth of a Nation. But should a rape allegation from his past make us look differently at his work, or even boycott the film, which many people have suggested? Second, Hillary's health. Donald Trump is throwing around allegations that she might be unfit, ill in all sorts of ways. What do we think about that? And finally, email etiquette. A New York Magazine writer says it's time to stop writing the annoying, "Hope you're well." So if that's true, why? And what are we supposed to write instead? And then finally, we have our Slate Plus segment. XX is relatively new to Slate Plus. It allows you to listen to our podcast ad-free and also hear an extra segment, which this week is Drinking Sexist. These segments are really fun, and if you want to sign up for them, go to SlatePlus.com/XX. June, and you have one more announcement for us.
I do. We have been talking about whether we should discuss the show Take My Wife, which is Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher, a real-life couple who have made a CISO series called Take My Wife about being lesbian comedians. And the reason we're unsure about whether we should talk about it is that it's on this slightly inaccessible network that you have to subscribe to watch. But it also has a month-long free trial. So we're kind of wondering how you feel about discussing shows like that. I watched it and like it, but it's a little off the grid. So your thoughts, please.
All right, let's move on to our first segment, Nate Parker. He's an actor and a director. He's at the prime of his career, about to come out with an ambitious movie called Birth of a Nation about Nat Turner and the Slave Rebellion of 1831. And then as the publicity is rolling out, media gets hold of some court documents from a rape charge against Parker from when he was a wrestler in college. These documents are full of pretty brutal details. He was acquitted. There was a trial. He was acquitted, though his friend and collaborator, Jean Celestin, he was convicted and still works with him on the movie. So now we've got a problem. We have an important, ambitious movie which calls America to account for past racial brutality, directed and starring a black man. It's his own project. Oof, but the allegations make it really hard to get behind that project. I actually think, guys, before we get going on the conversation about this, we should talk a little bit about what actually happened. Because when I was doing the research, I did it backwards. I like read all the opinions and then I read about the case. And it kind of makes a difference to know what actually happened in this case. He was on the wrestling team. These were his buddies. This was at Penn State. And any of you want to take it from there?
So as far as I understand it, and you can fill in any details that I'm leaving out, Parker was having sex with a woman who he had consensual oral sex with the day before, which I get featured heavily into the trial, that detail. And she had been drinking very heavily. She later did not really remember the incident. And Parker invited two of his friends to join him. And Celestine did. And another friend, Tamerlane Kangas, did not. And he was an eyewitness at the trial.
Right. Some of those details are contested, like how drunk she was. And also this third guy, Kangas, he was a key witness at the trial. And he says over and over again, that wasn't for me. Like, what? Four guys, four people in a room, not my thing, doesn't look good. Like, he was key in the trial. And also, it's important that she was white. Yes. Because that came up during the trial. The media around the trial had an element of, you know, the jury will never believe a black man who's being accused of raping a white woman. So that was an element in the trial. So when you guys read those allegations, like June, when you read the details, did that what was your reaction?
It reflects many of the complications of the case. I mean, yeah, when you focus on the trial, you think, three guys and a woman. The woman says that she was blackout drunk, that you have one response. You know, there, my sympathy is very much with the woman. Then you think, OK, this is a mostly white town, a college town, and the jury, 11 members of the jury were white. There was one woman of color. And that makes you feel a different set. That makes me feel a different set of emotions, where my sympathy are with the black men in a mostly white environment. And then you think, well, this is a sports focused college and these are athletes, and they have the sort of, you know, members of the administration stuck up for them. And that then makes, you know, changes my sympathies again. And I'm now taking my sympathies away from the guys because they're athletes, and that puts them in a, you know, brings up in a whole different set of categories. And then, you know, what did the university do when it came to the woman's accusations? And it seems uncontestable that they did a bad job. So bad, in fact, that the university was forced to pay a settlement to the woman for failing to protect her, not only from the situation in the first place, which I don't know how one can protect about that specifically, but about harassment that she suffered afterwards. That, you know, there are transcripts of the calls that Parker made to her trying to get her to, I guess, drop the case. And, you know, we should also note, earlier you said that Celestine was, you know, he got off, but he actually at first was found guilty, but then he appealed and the woman declined to testify a second time. So then he did get off, but it was not exactly a technicality, but, you know, not a clean acquittal.
And it also seems that the reason, I mean, the other thing that's important to note, the reason Parker got off, which Noreen mentioned, is because they had already had consensual sex. We think slightly differently about these things now. I think that wouldn't be maybe quite as much of a barrier now as it, or one hopes, as it was then. But that sort of like made him cleaner than his friend who had never had sex with her. Even though he was the orchestrator of the situation. Like, he was letting his friends in. He was the one having sex. He was the one who brought her home from the bar and said he was going to escort her safely, at least by her testimony. But yet that didn't matter because they'd had sex before.
And the tragic coda to this whole thing that I don't think we've mentioned yet is that the woman killed herself in 2012.
Right.
You know, you cannot, of course, draw any kind of direct line between that incident and this, but her family certainly sees it as a contributing part of her great sadness.
So I think then the question becomes, so somebody does something really bad when they're in college. It's some number of years later, and then they become an artist and they flourish. And so is there any space there? How do you judge whether you should forgive them or regard their art or take them seriously? And even more so in this case, because he's not just like making a cool movie, right? He's making a movie with kind of moral content that's been received that way. He's making a movie with a pretty serious message. It's his own passion project. So this isn't a Hollywood, this is like a thing he's doing himself and starring in. So how do we judge, you know, whether he's to be forgiven?
Well,
how do we go through that process?
first of
not
all,
forgiven.
Yeah, yeah. I was,
but, you know, that's the wrong word.
Should we go see his movie? Should we take our dollars to the box office?
Yeah.
Well, one thing that people are doing that I think is an incorrect comparison is they're comparing Nate Parker to Woody Allen and R. Kelly and Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski. Yeah, there's another one. And so I think, you know, whether you think the incident happened as Nate Parker says or not, it's a totally different incident. He was a college kid. Those men were in positions of power that they abused over and over and over again, right? I think they're just somewhat different analogies that just because he happens to have made a film, people are drawing those comparisons. As far as, you know, should you see his movie? Because, I mean, that's kind of up to you. Roxane Gay wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, you know, I'm not going to see it. I have this complicated personal history with sexual assault, and I just don't want to see it. You could also argue that Nate Parker has a complicated personal history with assault and with race and with America, and maybe that has informed, frankly, I can't imagine that his experience, 15 years ago did not inform the way he thinks about the world, that maybe it made him a more introspective person. Now, that's like quite a cost for that kind of introspection, but it's, you can't untangle the artist from his work, and whether you are willing to support it with your dollars is kind of up to you.
But, you know, he, to me, like, he did such a crap job of apologizing and talking about the incident. I got to say, like, I do watch those words carefully, and they were so defensive and self-absorbed, and like it was all about his own self-development. I feel like he did a terrible job of that. Like, he gave me no hint that he had processed this incident, or like, I do look for that. Like, I do look for some like accountability, some sense that you did something wrong, that you destroyed a woman's life. Now, I understand there's like legal considerations here, but not really. I mean, he was already tried, but like, there are ways to hint that you have like fully accounted for the thing that you did, and he did it all wrong. It was just like, I have, you know, I've got five daughters and a lovely wife, like, I'm good to the ladies, like, I have all, I'm surrounded by ladies and I love them all. That's fine, like, that's good, you know, I'm happy for that. I'm happy that he doesn't show that he's still like, you know. But it's just like, he held them up as shields, like how he brought his 6-year-old daughter to an interview where he suspected he would be asked about this. Like, that doesn't make me feel better about the way that he's thinking about women. Women have been such an important part of my life. I try every day to be a better father to my daughters and a better husband. That's good. You know, that's good. He's doing good things in his life. But I just feel like he just didn't like say sorry in any way. He didn't take responsibility for what had happened in any way.
Right. And not that, frankly, saying sorry can undo anything, or really, you know, it is a performance, and he performed it badly because maybe he doesn't feel it sincerely. Mm-hmm. But also, he's not pretending to make a feminist film. That, you know, like, he is not, he has said some, he said that he refuses to play gay characters because he wants to, quote, preserve the black man, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So he is not someone, he's someone who, you know, this is, he thinks about the world in a different way, maybe, than you and I do. And certainly in his art, at least at this point in time, that is not an important part of it. He is thinking about race in America. And
so, Noreen, you're landing at like, everyone should make their own decision, basically.
That it's America. That's where I always land.
Exactly.
I mean, one other thing I do want to bring up, I thought Willa Paskin wrote a really interesting piece on Slate this week saying, you know, that the criminal justice system in America is essentially in crisis. So he was tried for rape and acquitted. But we're at a point now where we don't trust that the justice system really gives anyone a fair shake. And in cases of rape and sexual assault, a lot of people presume that it doesn't give the victims a fair shake. And in other cases, people presume that it does not give young black men a fair shake. Mm-hmm. And so on either side of this, no one is trusting it because we a lot of people do not any longer trust that, you know, on balance, justice will be served, which is a far bigger problem. And maybe one we could, you know, be talking about a little bit more than we're talking about whether we should go see this Sundance movie.
It is interesting that he is at the nexus of both mm-hmm. of the times when we not only don't trust the criminal justice system, we don't even take the verdict seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as people were kind of digesting this, like nobody really took seriously who was acquitted and who wasn't acquitted and what actually happened in the criminal justice trial, his particular trial, because those are just two, you know, the young black man plus the rape victim means like we just don't even know what actually really happened, you know.
Yeah.
There's just no faith at all. I don't know where that leaves us except to just like let the media hash out the details of the case, which isn't much better.
Right. But another thing is that just you touched on this a little bit, Hannah, but norms are so different now. If we heard about this case today, you know, a woman who is, you know, blackout drunk and the guy, first of all, the guy that she's sleeping with is sleeping with her at all and then invites his friends in, you know, I think it would have gone differently. I really, really do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, I've said this before, like I hate leaving no space for someone to ever redeem themselves from something they did when they were a teenager. I really hate being in that place. I so agree with you that it's different from Woody Allen and R. Kelly mm-hmm. in that sense. It's like something that happened in his past and there should be a space for him to like live and be a human being after that. I just don't think he's quite earned it yet.
Yeah. He's been given opportunities to speak for himself, to explain himself, I think we've all sort of struggled with saying what exactly it is that we want. It's not to ask for forgiveness, but to show contrition, to show that he's changed, to show that he said that he had gained empathy, but there was no demonstration of empathy. Because I really want to see the movie. I want to see a movie made by a black man about the Turner Rebellion. I want that. But right now, I don't think I'm going to see this film.
Okay. Well, boycott the film.
No,
half boycott the film. Some of us boycott the film.
But we're never going to make, I mean, would we ever make that claim of like, no one should see this film? That's not what we do.
Hierarchies of pain. Like
right,
how many black men get to, you know, make their own
Absolutely.
Self-directed movie about a slave rebellion that gets a whole bunch of attention? Like how many times does that happen?
Never.
You know?
And just as a really interesting wrinkle to this story, the victim's family, which or the woman's family, who obviously, you know, have been somewhat outspoken in talking mm-hmm. about the pain this has caused her. Her mother, I believe it was her mother, one member of her family also said, you know, it's suspicious that the timing that people are ready to talk about it now is when his movie is coming into theaters, which I thought what she meant by that is that the people who restarted the talk about this maybe didn't want this particular film and this particular director to succeed. And, you know, she may be thinking conspiratorially, but I thought that was, you know, that's the person who is least likely to have any sympathy for the plight of this director.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that perhaps some of the restarting of the discussion around this was racially motivated. And that was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, help us out. Go on our Facebook page, Double X Gabfest, or email us and let us know if you are going to see Nate Parker's new film, Birth of a Nation. Okay, Donald Trump, with help from Sean Hannity and Rudy Giuliani and an army of internet conspiracy theorists, it started to suggest that Hillary Clinton is unwell and might not be fit to be president. Here's his latest statement, this one from this week. She also lacks the mental and physical stamina to take on ISIS and all of the many adversaries we face, not only in terrorism, but in trade and every other challenge we must confront to turn our great country around. Oh, man, the conspiracy theories. I don't know what we should do first, like go through all the various diseases that she's been accused of having.
Well, let's read the list that our wonderful intern Daniel compiled. He watched the conspiracy videos, so we wouldn't have to. Do you want me to do this? It's really
amazing.
Long. It goes.
Yeah, go ahead. Just go do a few of them.
I'll do a few. Okay. Weird seizures, facial tics, narcissistic personality disorder.
That's rich.
Yeah, exactly. post-concussion syndrome, mild Jacksonian seizure. I don't even know what that one means. Long bathroom break during debate. barely stand after giving speech, difficulty swallowing, choking, spontaneous outbursts of laughter, which are all symptoms of a stroke, Parkinson's disease, memory lapses, emotional illiteracy, that's a really funny one, high-functioning autism with attendant sociopathy, contracted syphilis from Bill, drug abuse. It goes on. Like, it really goes on.
What was the one at the end?
Gets really tired and collapses. I mean, who among us does not?
You, it's funny, like, you know, when you just read this list, I was thinking the core of this list is just like, I'm a 68-year-old lady, basically. Yeah. Like, there was an amazing one where the Drudge must read. It was like the big headline on Drudge this week, must read. And the must read was Hillary propped up on pillows.
Oh, yeah.
And it had like a million pictures of Hillary propped up on pillows. And I looked through all the million pictures that it had because it's like, you know, yeah, like she's 68 and like she, you know, it's just like me, like my lower back hurts. And so I put pillows under my back when, like, what is, how, is it campy? Is it explicitly campy? Like,
I think,
are they supposed to wink at each other that, like, you know, and I know that we're all full of shit? Or, like, is it working some other way?
I think that it's so crazy. There must be some, I wonder if there's any level on which it's meant absolutely seriously, although I guess some people are going for it. But I think it's maybe, like, if you, I know this is taking a conspiratorial turn, but I think, if anything, it's an attempt to get her to stop using the pillows. I mean, running for president is
to
really,
make her uncomfortable.
Yes, yes. Running for president is a really hard job. It's like, it is totally draining. And if you have a, you know, if you get like 0.005% energy from pillows, in these shits can take them, get her to take them away. Like, it's a tiny margin, but God knows they're desperate. I mean,
let Hillary have her pillows.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a serious, okay, so she's 68, Donald Trump is 70. As you just said, it's a high energy job. It's legitimate to be concerned whether these people, you know, like, health at that age, unfortunately, can change on a dime. Concerns about health are legitimate. These are not legitimate concerns about her health.
I totally disagree with that.
Oh, interesting.
I do not think, is it a legitimate public concern? This whole business of releasing health records, which is a fairly modern presidential thing, right? Nobody even barely knew FDR was in a wheelchair. It's like, if you can run for president, like, that's just how democracy works. Like, I have no right to see Hillary's private medical records. Neither of them, by the way, have released them. She hasn't, apparently. She's released fewer medical records than the average presidential candidates, and so has he. So they're both equal here. But why do I need to know about their health? Look, they're up on the stage. They're running. She's debating. She can walk. I can see with my own eyes. It is not my business, like, what her colonoscopy said. That's just insane.
Well, do you think it's your business what Donald Trump's tax return said? I mean, there's no obligation to show those either, but we want to know as voters.
Hmm.
I mean, also, by the way,
I'm trying to think of tax returns. I mean, there is an expectation of privacy with medical records. I think we all, it's like, it's not quite a human right, but we all expect privacy when it comes to our bodies and our medical records. So I think that's slightly of a higher order. Why do we have a right to see somebody's tax returns versus their medical records?
I'm sorry, but people in America talk about their health to anyone who will listen, particularly over the age of 65, frankly. Like, I don't think people are private about their health here. I think they're private about money. I think that is a much more difficult thing to get people talking.
Well, people choose what they want to disclose. I mean,
I think there are a lot of people in America who'd love to have everyone reading their health records.
Except if they, like, need to use adult diapers or something. I mean, you know, there are things that we
come on. There's, like, a law about this. There's
HIPAA.
It's just, like, why do we need to? Yeah, exactly. There's a law, and you sign it every time you go to the doctor. Like, why is it that we need to know, you know, specifically what Hillary's doctor has found, if she has, a spot here or a cyst there?
Well,
I
tell you, there's one thing, is that it stops this kind of intrusive speculation.
Wait till I finish speaking, please.
I want the long form.
Okay. I mean, I actually, I think that, I know that it's in the Constitution, but I really, as the oldest person here, I feel maybe more empowered to say it, but I think there should be a limit for politicians for how old they can run for office. They can be when they run for office. Maybe not the presidency, because, again, I don't want to see John McCain at whatever age he is, or, like, when, what was the senator from Pennsylvania who changed his party, and he was really old. And like, dude, why can't we not give younger people a chance? Why are these people holding on to office when some of them really are not well? But the presidency, I guess, is a slightly different situation.
Well, and just on the question of Hillary and Donald, you know, taking these two slightly older candidates, Hillary, like, does yoga. We know that she tries to eat pretty healthfully. Women tend to have better health in late middle age and old age than men. Whereas Donald Trump, whose doctor said that he's, you know, in top
excellent health,
excellent, like the best health, even though he takes like a cholesterol lowering pill and is photographed. I think he's been photographed eating both KFC and McDonald's on his private plane.
Right. With knife and fork.
With knife and fork. He really, really loves McDonald's. You know, he doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. But he does not give off the picture of a man in great health. He's sort of alarmingly colored at all times. And I don't think it's just the self-tanner. So if you were to like start conspiracy theories about one of these two candidates being in, you know, really bad health, it's crazy that Hillary's the one that it's happening to.
But it's all part of that like conspiracy machine. Like the left doesn't really, I mean, they dismiss Trump, and like those statues that went up around the country last week were totally fat shaming and like, you know, they were uncool. However, like that, so that's what the left does. But the left doesn't start like rumors about people the way that the right does.
Now, the other interesting thing about the conspiracy theory is it's, you know, because we've talked about the many forms of Hillary hatred and how it morphs and changes over time. This suggests a weakness. Usually, you know, usually it's the sort of the Clintons, the uber powerful, you know, the great conspiracy of the Clintons. And this taps into a totally different conspiracy of Hillary as like a weak old lady. You know, there was a grandma moment when they would call her Grandma Hillary, propped up on pillows and, you know, collapsing after every speech.
I mean, clearly there is a, like pretty much everything that that particular group of right-wingers does and says, it is a misogynist impulse. He is older, and yet he thinks he can get away with it because, well, for whatever reason, we have this image of like the virile older man, whereas the image of the older woman is, yeah, as you say, grandma. And you can kind of play on that, even though statistically there's no, you know, that doesn't hold up. It's just, you know, it's just part of the weird things that have come to pass. It's clearly an attempt to undermine her, to dismiss her, to make us just think, oh, that old lady, when he's an even older man. It's just silly.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out why this is, like, what's the sexist element? And I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it's that. It's like statistically, at 70, the woman is more likely to be healthier than the man, but the man can sort of pull out the virility card. You know, like he has a young, beautiful wife. His doctor gives him a, you know, stamp of approval. He can just like put on the face more easily, and people take that. People accept that, even though it's not true.
Right.
All right. Do we have anything more to say about this? Should I move on?
Well, what is mild Jacksonian seizure?
Let's look up before we leave. Let's look up what mild Jacksonian seizure is. I'm going to Google it right now while we're sitting here. I'm going to see if I have symptoms of Jacksonian seizure. You guys can do the music that would be on the video where I would do the public service announcement about Jacksonian seizure as a relapse. If you have mild Jacksonian seizure, you're likely to see these various symptoms. It looks like a relapse of MS. So she definitely does not have that. I think that.
Like, I'm looking at the things that they've accused Hillary of having. I'm trying to think which ones I might, like, convince myself I had. But the only one I can think I might be subject to is contracted syphilis from Bill.
Ooh, tell us more. Tell us more.
Great. So email etiquette. Emails exist in some weird zone between Slack and letter, and we never can quite decide what level of formality they are. So we get stuck with these kind of half-assed greetings like cheers or XO. Like there are different ones that people get stuck on. In the latest New York Magazine, Dana Evans complains about "I hope you're well," that it's like empty, robotic, insincere, And it's a kind of phrase you would never say to actual friends and family, which makes its insincerity all the more evident. I have to say, that article made me really self-conscious because, like, I never even knew that I wrote the words, "I hope you're well." They are such, like, dorky nothing words, and yet I do write them when I'm writing an email, and it just, like, it scrambled my brain a little bit, that story. Like, what am I supposed to write? And I got a little confused reading that. Like, do you guys then, did you do a catalog after you read it of all the do you guys have empty, meaningless things that you write in emails?
Yeah, and I totally do. Phrases. I hope you're well.
Me too.
All the time. And it I realize it sounds like very old-timey, like this person has just had a disease and you're writing to them after the long winter, you know? Whereas usually when I write it, it's to, you know, let's say it's to a writer who I haven't corresponded with in a year,
right,
and I want them to, you know, take on an assignment or whatever. And it feels like a cold, too much of a cold open, mm-hmm, to just be like, hey, like X dollars a word, want to do it, you know? Whereas
the answer is always yes, right?
This is a little like frigid verbal foreplay, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Just, but Dana is right that it is a weird phrase and that we can probably do better with our small talk.
But see, I agree. I mean, yes, stipulated. However, I hate being kind of lectured about stuff like that, because the things that she suggested, you know, just take a moment to think of something unique and you know, something that you're writing originally, you know, something, an original thought that's compiled just for them, which is actually still just a sentence. But that too just becomes, it's still just a little bit of foreplay before we get to the meat. And yet I agree that we don't necessarily want to get rid of it because we don't want to be too rude. It's, you know, the fact that when we're writing these kind of worky, but there's also an element of friendship or familiarity, or, you know, not just some cold dear, like what we would have years ago started a letter, dear sir, when there are people to whom we have some kind of type of friendly connection, you do want some, you know, foreplay. But I don't think we have to go to great lengths to be original when really you might just as well put the word friendly foreplay.
I love that, June.
I dare you foreplay. To use it. Let's see you put your money where your mouth
friendly
is.
Friendly foreplay. All right, I'll do it.
Do you guys have a lame one that you've been using? When she wrote that, I realized that the vacation one, like the one that pops up in the summertime, is also pretty lame. Like, hope you've been away, or like that. I feel like I use one in the summertime that assumes that people go on vacations. Hope you're well rested or some bullshit like that.
Whereas those of us who don't go away in the summer are absolutely exhausted, and because we're covering for all these vacationers. no, I'm exhausted. Thank you.
Well, so here's my question about it. Do you think that that there is a particularly gendered need to be nice over email? I've thought about this a lot. You know, since the dawn of email, people have written about what your salutations should be in email, how you should sign off, whether you should use exclamation points, you know, what the tone of an email should be, basically. How friendly are you required to be on the page? And I tend, and people have particularly written about the scourge of exclamation points in emails, that you now, we've reached a point in human history where you now look unfriendly if you're not using at least one and sometimes multiple exclamation marks, like per sentence. Sentence, you know, not just in an email. And I think about this a lot because I often ask people to do stuff over email and I want it to be with like a digital smile on my face, as cheesy as that sounds. But I also can't bear, there's also a version of an email that I find professional women in New York send that's like signs off with an XX or an XO to a person they've never met. And I can't do that. I'm like somewhere in between the two poles of just, you know, just straightforward telling someone what you want and like forced friendship. Do you think men are as anxious about this as women are?
I have no idea. I mean, yeah. I'm trying to think back. Like, I definitely, when I get emails from writers or people want to talk to me for some reason, I feel like it's a little bit of a hierarchy question. Like, the, if the person is younger than me or looking for something from me, they're trying harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it's a man or a woman. So in a professional setting, it just depends, like, where you perceive yourself up in the hierarchy, where if it's somebody who's, you know, doesn't give a shit whether I respond or not, they're a little more brusque.
Uh-huh.
But maybe we should all consider it a power move to not do the friendly cheers XO thing. Because I have as much trouble with the, like, I don't know what the after, like, not the foreplay, but the...
Is it the
what,
valediction?
Like the cigarette?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the after thing. Like, what are we supposed to call that? But, like, the affected British cheers that went around for a while. And then XO is just too girly for me, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I usually end up just writing H.
I do that too. Weird. No, I do that too. Or
you write H?
No,
I just like write my thing and then I write like thanks or whatever and then I just say H. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know what I actually want to write? I want to write God bless just because. Because it's so.
Start with friendly foreplay, end with God bless. It's the American way.
Yes. It's just slightly alarming. I feel like if people saw God bless, they wouldn't really know what to do with it. But I've never actually had the balls to do that. Yeah.
All right. So the type of email I find most charming are people who really like just actually send you interesting things in your email. Like I have one writer who always signs off with a couple YouTube links just to like random shit that I'll find interesting. And I kind of love that. Yeah. But he's got all the time in the world. Don't. But there is something fun about that where it, like someone who's actually excited to send an email and putting thought in it. And it like, I am happy to correspond with him and I reply to his emails more quickly because I've just watched the YouTube links. And I think, you know, depending on the volume of email you send, that might be impossible, but there's like a lost charm to letter writing. Mm-hmm. And there's an even more recently lost charm to email writing that people have, you know, the amount of it has overwhelmed people. And I think we all don't try as hard.
In the New York Magazine piece, that's a version of what Dana Evans recommends, which is that you personalize the emails. So, you know, her version is not as polite as sending a YouTube link or something you might like, but it's like, are you surviving this disgusting heat wave? This is just some of the examples she gives. Did you catch Merman Phelps's race last night? As a substitute, or is life in Chicago as great as it looks? You know, she says these are good sort of foreplay substitutes. What did you guys think of that? Like, June, does that just strike you as too much work?
I mean, it is work, and it is part of this problem of, are you doing it just for the sake of it? Because if you sincerely want to have a conversation about Michael Phelps's races or life in Chicago, that's great. But if you don't really want a reply and you're just essentially saying it just as that friendly opener, then that feels pointless to me. But I also I'm very cognizant that what we're essentially debating is it okay to be polite or how should we be polite? And there's always this thing, there's always been a debate about manners, like is having rules about which fork to use or which email salutation to use just a way of kind of keeping people in their places? Or does it make people feel comfortable because even as an outsider, you know what to do, you know how to do an email? And so I think, you know, it's as a form of politeness and as a given that a lot of the emails that we send, at least, I'm not sure how totally widespread it is, are sort of worky, but they're also, there's elements of personal email. Like they're kind of this weird hybrid. And so it's extra tricky to land that level of politeness and making people comfortable because it's a kind of a, like, if you think 10, 15 years ago, if we'd had to type the letter to get this information from people, would we have been ultra formal? Is it also part of the way that we've all become very informal and casual and just all the rules have been thrown out the window?
Not all emails are the same, require the same level of formality. Like, right. I think what we're all talking about is this mid-level where you know the person but not necessarily well. Mm-hmm. If it's an email to someone you don't know well, I would argue that you should err, at least on first email, on the side of formality with maybe not, I hope you're well because you don't know how they were before, but like, you know, signing off with something like regards or dear so-and-so would not be out of line and I think is actually a nice polite thing to do. And I guess I'm going to argue in favor of politeness, June.
Mm-hmm. I'm very, very pro politeness.
So here's something I completely have never figured out. So I'm often sending emails to sources, people I want to interview. How do you start that email? Is it Mr. or Mrs. something or other? Is it their full name? Like I kind of can see the person at the other end receiving my, you know, Mrs. Jones email and laughing at me. So I'm never, but then you write their full name, like, you know, Barbara Jones. I never know what the correct name salutation is. In the case of somebody you just totally don't know and who you're asking for a favor.
I think writing Barbara Jones is odd.
Yeah.
it is. Like, anytime someone says, "Dear Noreen Malone," I'm like, are you a bot? You know?
Right.
I don't know. I guess it depends. If it's like a professor or something, I might use their formal, or a doctor, I'll use their formal title. If it's someone, I guess I tend to err on the side of formality, like a Ms. so-and-so. But then it does, there's some occasions.
Did you do dear? Like dear Ms.? Like, let's say you're asking somebody who's an academic to write a story for you. And you know they're an academic and they've just written some interesting op-ed which you want to turn into a New York Magazine story. You would say what? Dear Mrs. Jones?
I guess I do a mix of formal and informal. I would do, hi, Ms. Jones. So millennial teeny bopper, hi, and 1950s formal on the goodbye. I don't know.
I think I would go not use their name in the, like, dear Mr. or whatever. I would just say hello or hi, or even, no, hey would be too informal. But I would try to...
Hey, yeah. Yo, Mrs.
Jones. Hey, girl, hey. But then I would try to include some personal information that made it clear that I had some sense of them, but, you know, in the email itself. But just as far as the salutation, I would just leave their name out of it. But I agree, that is the trickiest area, because you want to, because again, it's about hierarchy. Like, I do often use their title in a sort of slightly theatrical way, like, I am showing my deference and appreciating your title, especially like if I'm writing to dentists or whatever. I would always
common
I'm
quandary.
Often writing to dentists. Thank you.
Especially if I'm writing to dentists. That was so beautiful. That was the most June thing you've ever
they
said.
Love to be called they love to be called doctor, dentist too.
Dear Dr. Jones.
Yours in dental health, June.
I'm going to use that for Noah.
I hope your teeth are well. Wink, wink. All right, listeners, if you have any good solutions to the awkward world of email, the awkward problem of email salutations, please send them our way. Post them on our Facebook page, XX GabFest. Or send us an email with suggestions, and if they are good, we will collect them and perhaps read them on our next show. So let's move on to our recommendations. The first person we're going to hear from is our fabulous, beloved producer, Anne Hepperman. This is her last week producing the XX GabFest. We love you, and we thank you, Anne.
Yay! Aww, thanks! Woo! Yay!
It's been so delightful. All of you listeners don't know how helpful Anne is behind the scenes, helping us get the show together, putting it together afterwards. Also, the thing I will miss most, Anne is a genius at choosing music for the show.
Yeah.
You have all benefited from that for a long time, so we're going to really, really miss that.
Thanks.
In our Great Slate tradition, Anne is going to give us a recommendation this week.
Well, I'm going to – can I make two?
Go
ahead. Is that okay?
Go ahead. Break the rules.
Okay. First, this one is going to be pretty simple and log rolly. So there's this author, a young adult author, children's book author, who does really amazing work. Her name is Christine Hepperman.
Hepperman?
Yeah.
Any relative?
Disclaimer, she is my sister. Critics also agree that she is a fantastic writer. And she has a couple of books that that came out recently. One is called Poisoned Apples, Poems for You, My Pretty, which is, this is going to sound horrible, but it's an amazing book. It's feminist poems for young women that are use fairy tale imagery.
Yeah, cool.
And so it's gotten starred reviews all over the place. And Hannah, I think you, did you read this? I can't remember.
I did. I love that book. It's a great book. I keep it around at home, and my daughter's read it. It's a really, really, really interesting set of poems about essentially the kind of anorexic undertones of fairy tales. It's really great.
Yeah, and then her latest book is called Ask Me How I Got Here, which it resonates with me on a number of levels because it's about this teenage girl. It's a story in verse, and it's about this young girl going to a Catholic high school who she gets pregnant, has an abortion, and what? Nothing bad happens to her. So anyways, and plus she's my big sister. She's like 8 years older than me, so I've admired her like my entire life and followed her around. And so anyways, anything by Christine Hepperman you should get and buy because it's fantastic. But there's this blog. It's called, Flavor Added, Undercooked and Overheated Notes on the History of Artificial Flavors. It's by this PhD student, Nadia Berenstein, from the University of Pennsylvania. And that's her her specialty is the history of science. And she has this blog post called, Is That Celery in Your Pocket or Are You Just Happy to See Me? Which she goes down all of these like crazy rabbit holes that you enjoy following her down. But then she has these like, I'm just going to show this picture to June right now, like these kind of anatomic illustrations that she will make of like,
I love that.
Various like celery with boobs. There's a celery with, well, an anatomically correct celery, you know, that she'll also put in there. But the thing that I like so much about this blog is just you're really going down the rabbit hole with this mind. But she's so fun and playful that you just don't mind that you're reading about, like, how celery and boar taint are related. While at the same time really learning and deconstructing like academic myths about flavor science.
Wow.
Right?
Cool.
Yeah. So the blog is Flavor Added, Undercooked and Overheated Notes on the History of Artificial Flavors.
Wow. Sounds excellent. All right, June, what do you have for us?
Well, first, I want to, of course, recommend Anne's podcast, which in part she is off to spend more time on, Serendipity, which is a look at fiction, audio fiction, is that what you call it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, maybe if you grew up in England, as I did, you may be familiar with, like, BBC radio dramas, but and there's a little bit of that kind of standard, I guess you would say, and often awesome audio drama, but also all kinds of nonfiction audio. So I heartily recommend Serendipity. But I also want to recommend Jeffrey Toobin's new book, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes and Trial of Patty Hearst. Now,
I've been so curious about that.
Well,
I'm so curious about
it's, that. I'm slightly torn because I consider myself a bit of a Patty Hearstologist. I have been reading about her since I was a child and have read many books about her. And this one is peculiar. Like, I'm very curious. I'd love to hear why he chose to write it, because he didn't have access to her or to really anybody. And he did get, for the first time, access to some letters that she wrote to her her lover at the time that she was arrested, another revolutionary. But there's not that much that's actually new, but what is new is just the kind of the passage of time. And one of the things that we often talk about here of how things seem different now just because of our current mores and standards. And so it's interesting just because it's written in 2016. And it is a fascinating case and it was a fascinating time. So I recommend it, but if you know the outlines of the case, it's probably not going to tell you anything new. But he's a fine writer who keeps things moving along.
I actually just started it. I'm like 40 pages in, and at least so far it's blowing my mind with how different things are. Like, you know that. I know the story of Patty Hearst, but just the details that you hear, like, it makes our current times seem a little less crazy by comparison.
Totally.
Okay, my turn. I have been off for 3 weeks, so really I have nothing but recommendations. Like, I could have 5 billion recommendations.
That's awesome.
I've just been like suctioning up like fiction, nonfiction, movies, TV. Oh. It's been so fabulous. I'll dole them out over time. I'm just going to say two because I was thinking like which one is most vivid in my mind. Unfortunately, David Plotz, me husband, stole this one. But the book is so freaking good. So for our listeners who have not, who don't listen to the Political Gabfest, I'm going to double it. It's Underground Airlines by Ben Winters. So you might know him from The Last Policeman, which is a series that he did. Underground Airlines is an amazing book that's an alternate history of America where slavery continues in what's called the Hard Four, which are the southern states. And the central character is a freed slave who is himself a slave hunter. And it's just an incredible, incredible book. Unlike David, I'm not a consumer of alternate histories. They usually irritate me because they're rigged and constructed and they fall apart. But this one does not fall apart, and it's just so gripping and fabulous. And the second book I want to recommend, he has been everywhere. I've heard a lot of interviews with J.D. Vance, who wrote a book called Hillbilly Elegy, which is about his Appalachian family. Just in this Trump moment, I super urge you to either listen to an interview with J.D. Vance or read this book. His family is unbelievable. You know, just this like Appalachian family that he grew up in is exactly everything that you might imagine that it would be. But as a result, he's got this really particular take on poor and working class whites that I've pretty much never heard before. So it's really, both of those books are fantastic.
Awesome.
All right, Noreen.
So recently I found myself living one of my worst nightmares, which is I was about to board a plane with no reading material.
Oh.
So at the airport bookstore, I bought The Valley of the Dolls 50th Anniversary Edition, which Slate's own Simon Doonan wrote the foreword for, actually. And it's like not a good work of literature, but I just inhaled it. And for the week I was reading it or whatever, I just always had this sense like, oh, what old time movie was I just watching lately? And it wasn't an old time movie. Like it was Valley of the Dolls, which has this like cinematic. It's slightly trashy, obviously, but just the plotting and the soap opera quality of it just really consumed me. So it's not like a good work of literature, again, but like if you just want to be absorbed by a fun book this summer, pick it up, read it on a plane.
Awesome.
All right. Well, that's our show for today. For the last time, thanks to our beautiful producer, Anne Hepperman. We will miss you. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts, Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our fabulous intern is Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to find out more about the show and read our recommendations is at slate.com/XX, or you can find all that on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, where you can also leave comments about the show and suggestions for future shows, or you can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.